Welcome to Smashy Business Show. Today I have with me
Richard Fitzgerald.
And I'm Wart Ahmed. And today we're going to be discussing how UAE businessman Khalaf Al-Habtour urges Emiratis to appreciate their blessings amidst UK family outings decline that he noted. And we'll also be discussing how Kareem introduces Quick Electronics with high discounts at the same time that Amazon Prime is going to be launching their discounts. And thirdly, we will be speaking about how Dar Global and Trump Organization are going to be launching the Trump Tower in Dubai. Yeah. But firstly, before we begin with all of that, something that I really want to discuss with you today is, you know, what does business mean to you? You know, business, something that I'm noticing is that there is this misconception that business is all about numbers, it's all about statistics and logistics. But business, it's a story. It goes beyond numbers. And what I want to know is, what does business mean to you, Richard?
Well, good morning, Ward.
I've seen
you hosting the show with my colleagues so far, and you've done an excellent job, so it's a pleasure
Thank
to
you.
Be on the show with you. Friday, 19th of July, the roads are empty, the weather is hot, but business always goes on. And, you know, to answer the question and the nice intro segment that you prepared this morning, you know, I always think that business is the ultimate sport and it's the ultimate playing field. There are rules, but the size of the pitch can change, and it's kind of up to you what size playing field you want to, what impact you can create and where you want to play. And the wider rules of governance and society are also there. You know, there's been a lot of thought and, how would I say, theory into, you know, acronyms in the last sort of couple of decades in terms of profitability, the role of impact in business, ESG, you know, governance, environment, and, you know, the social impact of what one can do. I just finished reading a book by economists, and it talked about, it was Grow the Pie, and it talked about, you know, that abundance mindset and growing the pie. And, you know, if you grow the pie as a mindset for your sector, it also can be a mindset for society and kind of wider impact. You know, I don't like the phrase, I've said this before on the show and other podcasts, I don't like the phrase business is business, because it's sort of got a Machiavellian feeling to it. And it's sort of, you know, almost like the end justifies the means, and it's like, it's just business. No, like why do we have negative connotations associated with business? Why can't business be seen as good? Like we're in almost the middle of the 21st century, and clearly of all the sort of societal ideologies, the one that's dominant is capitalism, but it doesn't mean that it can't have human rights, it can't have equality, equity, it can't have all these things. So it's about finding the balance there. But I think on the positive side, business can provide a vocation, it can provide food on the table, it can provide environments where people can be the best version of themselves in terms of their intellectual capacity, and it can also drive social change as well, and innovation, technology, many things.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you in that sense. I was actually one of the people who had a very negative perception on business. And it was actually a story, a specific story that changed my mind. You know, as you said, business, it puts food on people's tables. You know, from this, we know that when businesses gain money or when they lose money, people are affected. And we specifically see this in the post office scandal. I'm not sure if you heard of it, but basically in between 1995 and up until 2015, there was the post office scandal in the UK. And what basically happened is that over 900 postmasters were accused of stealing money. But they didn't steal money. What basically happened was the system that basically records the entire money, it basically identified that there was a shortfall of money. And what happened after that is more than 900 postmasters were accused of stealing non-existent money at that time. And what this case did is that it caused many people, you know, they lost their money. There are 4 suicide cases linked to this case study. But from this case, we see how, you know, when business goes right, you know, businesses can win. But when businesses go wrong, people can lose. And you know,
absolutely.
Yes, and just on the focus of people on the UK, have you seen what Khalaf Al-Habtour has said?
That's a good segue. I saw the headline on the Smashy Business Instagram and on our newsletter. So Khalaf Al-Habtour is a renowned and successful Emirati businessman. He's outspoken on different topics, and I think we need these regional voices and these esteemed successful voices who talks sense. And you know, every country that he visits, he provides commentary. I know when he goes to Egypt, he provides commentary. He's been talking lately about Lebanon, and we've covered that on the show with the TV station that he looked to launch there. But yeah, so tell us about the UK.
So basically what happened is that, you know, Khalaf Al-Habtour, the founding chairman of Al-Habtour Group, said that in the UK, families no longer enjoy outings. Emiratis, be grateful for our blessings and stay resilient. While I do think that, you know, what he said is true, we do have an amazing quality of life in the UAE. You know, we really do have to ask, is his opinion completely true? Do you believe it's completely true?
I think, I definitely think the standard of life that we have here is excellent. And I think it's safe. And I think we're a little bit spoiled. And, you know, we have utilities, we have many things. The economy is good, but it's not for everyone, right? Some people are struggling. And that, you know, to compare countries, and we do it a lot on Love in Dubai, and, you know, to say the benefits of Dubai is fine. But I think, you know, this sort of mindset of this worldview that, you know, you can make out of what you've got is sort of that people in the UK can have a nice life, and people in the US and in New York, sure, there are statistics of crime rates, and there's a much spoken about cost of living crisis in the UK at the moment. It doesn't come up as much in the summer, but when they don't need as much energy, but you know, when it's not as cold. But when the winter comes around again, we'll hear of it again. You know, there's linked to politics, there's linked to geopolitics, there's linked to lots of different things there. I just felt like, well, I'm from Ireland, and I used to live in Dublin, and then I spent a few years in London, and I wanted to move to London because I thought it was more exciting and for a young career as Dublin. But when I got there, I realized that I missed the boat by about 50 yeah. years. And what I mean by that, like the swinging 60s and the feeling of zeitgeist in a city when a city is being built might have more pressure on speed and time and fast deadlines. But you can be part of that journey. You can be part of building that city. But London was built. Like the buildings were built, the tube was built, the time it takes to get progress in your career is harder yeah. because there's more people in place and the economy is at a mature level. So it chugs along, but it chugs along at a slower growth rate. Whereas in the emerging markets, it's more risky, there's more volatility, it's more pressure on young people, but it moves faster, grows faster. And I think some of those comments were to do with like social events and going out and eating out and the safety of eating out and the cost of eating out and the blessings that we have here. Even in the summer, you know, I went to a cafe over the weekend with my wife, and it was the middle of the heat. It was the middle of the summer, and we just enjoyed the lunch so much. We just saw lots of families around us eating, and we just thought, well, you know, it's a mindset that we can read, and we really did appreciate to go what he said. Like he said, he was speaking to Emiratis that they should appreciate their blessings, be grateful, and stay resilient. And we really felt that. And I think people can really feel that in the UAE and the wider region.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. But people are saying that for him to compare and contrast the UK and the UAE is very unfair. And they say this because, you know, the UK, it's more of a welfare-centered system. You know, in the UK, they have the NHS, they can get maternity leave, and people actually in the UAE commented saying that, you know, some of us, we fix our teeth and we don't have money to eat anymore.
It's almost like a poem, someone like a phrase, fix our teeth, we can't eat. that's a good one. Look, you know, are we talking about ideologies and governance and countries? Like, I do respect the labor law, I respect the leadership in any country. And I think you as a part of society, your role isn't to complain or second guess. If you want to get into politics, get into politics. You know, if you want to do what your vocation is, get on with it, you know? And I think people who constantly talk about other things that they're not really educated for and they're not really experts on, it doesn't really help, you know. Sure, we could go around the 206 countries in the world and we could compare, like, you know, not just UK and UAE, and we could say, what's the maternity leave in every country? What's the tax in every country?
Yeah.
And imagine there wasn't 206 different maternity leaves and 206 different national days and 206 different, I'm just picking that rough number of countries in the world, it's give or take 10 or 15, who knows. Maths got redrawn there. No, but so, you know, I think, do we want one global government? And if we pick one global government and we pick one rule, one health system for the world, is that going to work better than this?
Yeah.
So, you know, I think what's nice about, you know, people say we don't have democracies, but we do in a way have leaders here who are making decisions for the people in this country. And that's all that a government does in my country, you know. And I don't necessarily, especially on Smashy Business and the mindset that we try and the stories that we try and cover, like, I think what we just want is respect for the emerging market, the region here, and that people are building for here and are doing well here. And you know, a lot of respect for the British Empire and what is and what was. And I wouldn't want London per se to be diminished as a financial capital of the world. It's a fantastic place.
Yeah, and I definitely agree with you. I feel that his comment does have some unconscious bias in it, because, you know, he's Khalaf al-Habtour. Is he frequenting the same places that, you know, normal middle class families are frequenting?
Yeah, look, I mean, fair. I, you know, I won't defend him, but that's kind of saying just because he's rich, he's out of touch with the poor. And, like, that's a bit of a generalization. It's fine. But look, he is Khalaf al-Habtour, and he's Emirati, and he's proud of what he is here. But again, going back to the early point, we need these business leaders. If we kept listening to Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk, we'd be taken down a different path. The fact that we have someone who generally wants the best for his people, like the leaders here, speaking out, being proud, and telling people, which is true. Ward, when I left London in 2012, my bosses, who were 10, 15 years older than me, said, why are you going there? I always say this with, you know, for the audio people listening, I'm using blinkers in my eyes. Why are you going there? 2-3 million people, you know? Why aren't you thinking somewhere bigger? If you look at the population graph from 2008 to 2024 in the UAE, it's gone from about 8 million up to nearly 12 million people. That's a big number.
Yeah.
Percentage-wise, in 10, 15 years. So I think my bet was right. And I think, you know, the other point of that sort of mindset is that we do believe in the UAE, we do bet on the UAE, but we do need people to understand the differences and to appreciate it here as well, and not to complain as much. I'd respect for leadership, but not to complain as much anyway, because why shouldn't you be grateful every day?
Yeah, you're right. And we do have something to be grateful for. The famous giant Careem launches Quick Electronics with big discount. Big discounts aligning its launch with Amazon Prime Week. And the reason why this is really special is because what Careem is doing is that they're leveraging human empathy. Mm. Don't you think so?
In what way?
They're leveraging human empathy because, especially at a time where their business is booming, instead of maintaining that momentum and, you know, pushing that constant selling pedal, what they're doing is that, you know, they're being a bit lenient with their customers. You know, by them giving them these discounts, by, you know, giving them these services, they will create something long lasting. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I definitely, you know, when we talk about the companies like Careem, the technology-driven companies that are, you know, there's not many people who run these companies like being called super apps, but everything they add just becomes more and more encompassing. You know, originally this was seen as sort of the gig economy, and how are these companies regulated? Are there captains or are there employees? Do they have the same labor law contracts as everything else? And I think it's a global conversation. Go back to what we're saying about fairness in different parts. There's been lots of regulation in the US around these companies. When it's here, it's seen as a UAE situation in terms of the labor force, you know, what MORI, the Ministry of Human Resources and Labor, what they manage, it's seen as their responsibility to make sure that there's empathy for the captains and on that side of things. So in terms of empathy for their customer, yeah, look, I think it's a business decision, right? Because if they, you know, Kareem have moved into other areas. And I love how after the Uber acquisition, Uber shut down Uber Eats and Kareem became the company that we knew to do many other things. They do quick delivery, that we can send boxes, right? You know, 7-8 years ago, I remember being in Astrolabs, or 9 years ago in JLT when we were starting Love in Dubai. And at the time, the word on the street was Fetcher, that they were going to do the box delivery. And now Kareem does it, and that company I don't think exists, or maybe it's more B2B now. But so everyone uses the multifaceted, and it was said that only Asia has apps that are super apps. And in the US, it's a little bit more streamlined. But now we're getting that Kareem part, and now we'll be sending money. I know they made a play into fintech, and now they're going into this retail space. There's two trends here, Ward. There's the quick, the 15-minute type delivery thing. Noon on their website have Noon Minutes. Yeah. And then this one now is the retail part. And each of these supply chain have different challenges to them, right? So for groceries, there's challenges of, you know, the store where the groceries come from are a certain type of a store. The store where electronics come from is another type of a store. So this this quick commerce is two things. It's getting things to people faster. People hate friction. People love utility and speed. And it's also moving into probably the noon Amazon electronics 15 minutes thing. So it's a fascinating move. It's a fascinating thing. I think watch this space in the region. Definitely there was, I think there was a $500 million buyout between Etisalat and Kareem to kind of bring some of that control back to Kareem away from the transport area of smart mobility of Uber. And now Kareem can be this super app for the region. The other one really to look out for is Noon. I don't think Noon's story has been fully documented properly, but initially, Hamid Al-Arbour put $1 billion into that to take on Amazon. And then in 2021, PIF in Saudi bought 50% of that company. It wasn't a minority investment. It was a chunky investment. So instead of building their own e-commerce speedy thing to take on Amazon, like this whole encompassing e-commerce platform, they made a bet with Hamid Al-Arbour, and they both injected another $1 billion each. So you got $3 billion into that thing, and it's doing really well, right? Like, it's not profitable in all sectors, but it's fast, it's speedy, it's got Noon Minutes and this sort of thing. So now that we've got Kareem independently making decisions for the region, and we've got Noon as well, and we've got Amazon, and we've got many other players, many more niche players as well.
You know, Richard, you said something that caught my attention, and it's about having empathy for the drivers. The reason why I believe this launch over here, it's a smart move, is because actually last year, Kareem launched something called Dirhams for Delays. And basically what it is that for every minute delay by the driver, basically, the customer, they'll be compensated for that 1 minute that the driver is late. And in that case, this marketing campaign didn't work out. And it didn't work out because a lot of people said that, you know, this might cause the drivers to have accidents on the road. And so we're seeing in this case that, you know, empathy marketing schemes, they do work. But they do work when, you know, not only are you looking out for your customers, but you're looking out for the people who actually work for your business. Mm. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it's a little, you know, going back to this view of capitalism versus socialism and everything, I do think it's a little unfair to say that people who are delivering for Kareem are treated badly. Like, it's too generalism, you know? I think we've seen on Love in Dubai over the years, we've been covering captains and drivers, and we see that people do have empathy at the door. They are leaving water out in the summer. But it's a vocation, you know, and it's a type of a job, right? Yes, it's a service job, but we've all had service jobs, right? I've worked in restaurants and things like that. We've all had different jobs. And I do think, yes, these gig economies and these big corporates have to look after their people more. And the same point, they are creating thousands and thousands of jobs. You know, one of the reasons, Ward, that we set up Smashy originally is inspired by people who work for the types of Kareem. You know, I was working in social media agencies and going to places like Amman in Jordan or Erbil in Iraq, and I would see people doing second jobs, Kareem captains, providing food on their table for their family, right, in the evening after work. So why is that a bad thing? Yes, sure, they could pay them more, but at the same time, they need to make more money as well, and the unit economics needs to work, right? But if you're looking at unemployment rates across the region decreasing and more people getting vocation, this is great. Like, outside of the Gulf, and not all the economies in the Gulf are doing well, but outside of the Gulf, we've got big, big populous nations with currency issues, with CPI issues, with inflation issues. And the more people that have jobs, whether it's cream jobs or not, is good. So if we criticize, you know, if we criticize the big tech companies that are creating lots of jobs, and that people can argue saying, well, are they taking away, you know, when you were talking about the post office earlier, I was thinking of email and you know, technology yeah. can replace. But ultimately, you look at the number of labor that work for the likes of Kareem and the likes of, you know, Noon and these companies, it is providing more jobs. And yes, we do want the type of job profile to be higher, but a job is a job, right? You know, in Saudi, they've got great 2030 agendas, and in the UAE, they do as well. But one of the agendas in Saudi is, especially in our space, in the media space, is to have those quality jobs. There's an Ignite program, and the agenda specifically is, okay, we're going to have 1 million new jobs created in the hospitality sector through the Saudi tourism initiatives and Red Sea Global, and you know, young Saudis who are going to go to hospitality courses, and they're going to do tourism. Like, if you go to Al Ula, you're brought around these UNESCO World Heritage sites by young Saudis tour guides, right? So these are vocations. And then there's another level of job, which is higher pay. It's more intellectual in terms of you're working with software and technology and people every day, and it's less service, but there's still a degree of service in it. You know, the jobs that we provide in media are perceived to be higher than a Kareem captain job. However, for us, it's still service industry. We're still servicing clients. The work that we're doing, it's still, you know, even at the higher level of some of these companies, it can still be manufacturing. It can still be services as well.
You know? And actually, another really good relevant example is that during COVID, eBay, they launched an initiative called Up and Running. And basically, what Up and Running is, what it did is that during COVID, obviously, many businesses closed down. According to the Washington Post, more than 100,000 small businesses closed down in the U.S. And what eBay did with Up and Running is that they created an e-commerce app that would allow small businesses in the US to run their businesses. They gave them free advertising tools, you know, free discounts to ship their products. And I really think this goes a long way to show how, you know, if you really show a bit of leniency with your customers, it can go a long lasting way to strengthening your business.
Yeah, I think they're good examples that you made. I think, you know, maybe, and that's the point, that they are thinking of their employees, but introducing electronics is a way of seeing that their customers want these services and providing that better. You know, Bezos always says with Amazon is, you know, the customers, be obsessed with the customer, make things simple for the customer. You know, comes from that old adage of the customer is always right, the client is always right. But this obsession with the customer, Kareem seemed to be adopting in some way.
But do you believe that empathy marketing in business, does it always work?
It definitely doesn't always work. So, you know, marketing is marketing. Marketing is trying to persuade. I think action speaks louder than words. And I think, you know, people really shouldn't do these things for marketing stunt purposes.
I definitely agree with you. And a very significant example to me is, you know, when you go on YouTube and you see those the Gaza ads that are asking you to donate, those charities, and you see these very violent images. Does that actually motivate you to donate?
You know, it depends how one perceives causes and one perceives one's knowledge about charities and the impact that they can do. You know, I think there's a lot of history in marketing showing that charities that do show the conditions of countries and the plight of humans in certain countries does have that shock factor, and does make people realize, you know, going back to what you're saying about comparing countries, does make people to realize that there are people suffering out there and they do need our help. So I don't think we should sugarcoat it too much, but You know, marketing is marketing. They're choosing those images with an intent to either persuade or create awareness or to convert.
But you know that shocking effect, it doesn't always work. Like, for example, there is this new marketing scheme that was employed, social swipe. And with social swipe, what you basically see is, you see a piece of bread. It's a billboard, the first launched in history. And within this piece of bread, you can swipe your card, and then immediately it will show you this film sequence. So, for example, a family in Peru. And the visuals that it uses, you know, they're very calm, they're very serene. Like, you see a very fresh loaf of bread, you see a very happy family in Peru. Mm. And actually, people have been investing into this initiative. And I think it's because of the fact that the marketing that they use, yes, you know, it's getting their empathy. They're showing them a loaf of bread, you know, but they're showing them images that aren't violent.
Yeah.
And, you know, now moving on to the last topic.
Yeah.
Dar Global, the real estate giant, has launched the iconic Trump Tower in Dubai.
Yeah.
The Trump Organization.
Yeah, fascinating word. The timing of all this, it's just fascinating. Yeah. It's like, it's Trump 2.0, isn't it? He's on Truth Social, but the whole we're heading into four more years. Let's see, 8 years ago when Trump came, his first foreign visit was to Saudi Arabia. It was at the time when we weren't used to Trump development properties in the region. They launched the Trump Golf Course in Dubai, and since then we've heard other announcements. So Donald Trump Jr. has been on Emirates' first class flight over to Oman a few weeks ago to announce the project there with a local initiative. And Dar Al Arkan Global, Dar Global, announced the Trump Tower in Jeddah a few weeks ago. And hot on the heels of that, we're now getting it in Dubai. This is amazing. I mean, look, first of all, this city can attract anything. And the towers that they build here, those hospitality hotels, multifunctional gyms, retail, residence, you know, the buildings and the construction is incredible here. And, in New York, Manhattan was built on this, and that's why Trump Tower is in Manhattan. On what side, I think what the fascinating part of this is the branding related to your politics, related to America, related to, but I think on some level, we need to distance ex and president elect with a global global construction and global brand that's related to the hospitality sector with hotels and towers and buildings, real estate company. So first of all, if we differentiate those, then we have to say, okay, what's the role of a global brand in the region when we've got so many of our own good developers?
Yeah.
And the view of capitalism, the view of economics, and the view of the world is let everyone compete, let everyone come in and see how good they have to offer.
But, you know, even more interestingly than this, this coincidental event, it's amazing because if you guys take a look at Smashy Business a while ago, we posed the question of, you know, will the attempted assassination of Trump affect Middle Eastern deals for like security reasons?
That was one of your good opinion pieces earlier in the week, Ward. Yeah.
And we can clearly see that it didn't do that. If anything, it motivated the Middle East to have partnerships with Trump because they saw his assassination as a show of strength, as a show of defiance.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, definitely. And the media narrative around the assassination attempt, and you know, let's be respectful for the incident that happened. People did die at that event last Saturday or last weekend. So it's very tragic that's happened. And politics in the US does seem at a heated level at the moment. Looking at Dar Global and Waleed Shahabi, who has been our guest every Wednesday on the show, who's the founder of a property app, Keeper, he educated me and our audience a little bit, I hope, about the role, the decisions that Dar Global is making now, from construction to being a brand itself, and the partnership choices. We've seen the Swajanis with Damac partnering with Trump in the past.
The 18 golf course.
Yes, exactly. And that word, and that almost, for the layperson, felt like Hussein Swajani was Trump's partner in the UAE. So everywhere else where the Trump group was launching in Oman and Saudi, it's not necessarily where the Damac group is, But now for Dar Gobel to enter Dubai with Trump, but who already had a partner here, is interesting, right? We've seen Aldar, who kindly invited us to the NBA basketball in Abu Dhabi this week. Aldar is seen as an Abu Dhabi real estate firm. They announced a big development in Dubai recently. So Dubai has already been competitive enough, but rather than us talking about brands from Dubai going into the region, what we're seeing is brands from Saudi and Abu Dhabi are coming into Dubai as well with new projects. And I often hear, even in our sector, people say, is the UAE saturated? Is it oversaturated? No, it's not, right? Is New York, is Manhattan oversaturated? I was walking through downtown recently with my wife and we saw the Benghazi development going up. And I described, it was on a plot of land that hadn't been developed before, and it's going to be a super tower and it's amazing looking. And what I described was, in Dubai, these towers crop up in new plots of land. In Manhattan, you have to knock down something that was built in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, and then you build something even better. So until downtown, until Dubai gets to that stage, but that will be the future. It'll never stop, is my point. The Trump towers will always come. Yeah. It won't ever be saturated. We had a tour, a bit of an exclusive here on the show, but we had a tour yesterday of a new development, a massive development in the Westin Complex Hotel. They've knocked down three old F&B outlets to create a 20,000 something square foot golf experience called Five Iron. It's a franchise from the US. This has got, I won't do all the numbers, I won't do it all justice because I'll wait for the reveal to come out, but basically, it's basically an indoor golfing simulation experience, and golfers were fascinated that the UAE is such an indoor place for many months of the year that they didn't have one of these, and they've already got 17 or 18 of them in the US. There's another brand in the UK called Pitch, and now it's launching here. And some people might say, well, why launch it? You won't have the demand, but there is the demand. If you build value, I'll never forget when we were building these studios. A restaurateur in Dubai of X Group, so of Tom and Serge, Tom Arnold, who recently was recognized at the Michelin Awards for opening of the year with the Guild in that stunning building in the IFC, IC Brookfield building. The Guild is a stunning restaurant, and
oh, I loved it.
It's amazing,
visited,
right?
You've seen it recently,
right? So he was building that. I remember seeing a tour of it, and we would talk when we were doing construction here, and, is it worth it? Is it worth doing the fit out? Is it worth doing the investment? And his view of, if you're creating value, if you're putting something in place that's value, it's always worth it for the customer. Going back to your empathy points and doing what's right for the customer. So I think that is the bottom line here on these developments. And partnerships are always a good thing. Don't underestimate partnerships. Going back to the first point of business at the start, if you've got a grow the pie mindset, if you've got abundant mindsets, you do think of partnerships. You don't think of zero sum game. You don't think of killing your competitors. You think of adding to it.
I see what you mean. And, as Richard said, the Trump Towers, they will keep coming. And Eric Trump himself confirmed this to the Financial Times. He said something along the lines of, I don't work in a government office. And he will keep pursuing these deals in the Middle East, whether Trump is elected or not.
Yeah.
And, I have a question for you, Richard. Do you believe Trump winning will affect crypto?
I think every big significant thing, look, the size of the American economy, and we should bring our guest on, he's waiting patiently outside, but the size of the American economy, the number of trillions, anything can impact everything. So anything significant, such as a presidential decision on tax or anything like that, or any regulation, can impact anything. I do see that he's, not to talk politics, but he has nominated a tech-savvy vice president running mate, J.D. Vance, who's in his 30s and spent 5 years in Silicon Valley. So I do think he's in touch. There's been a big wave lately, word with a lot of the tech Silicon Valley people rowing in behind Trump. Not just Silicon Valley, but we have Peter Thiel, we have all the people from Shamat and all the guys from the All In podcast. Those guys are talking a lot with saying why we need to get behind Trump. A big investor, Bill Ackman, is getting involved in this. So there's a, going back to, again, to a recurring theme on this episode, is that Trump 2.0. I do think we'll see a lot of new things happening. Crypto, Bitcoin's touching back down near 50. It hasn't fully dropped. I believe in Web3. I think we will see a reemergence of it at some point. NFTs and the like. But let's see.
Yeah, and by the way, last month, analysts at Standard Chartered said that the US presidential election will basically boost the price of Bitcoin if there is a Trump victory, and it could actually push it up to as high as $150,000 by the year end. Are you excited?
I'm excited about that, yeah.
Yeah. And with that being said, we're going to be taking a break for now. We have a really exciting interviewee coming up.
Welcome back. Ward here with you again, Richard. And Ward, we're joined by Yusuf Omar. He's a multi-award-winning journalist and co-founder of Hashtag Our Stories. Yusuf is former CNN senior social media reporter on Snapchat and the former mobile editor of the Hindustan Times, which you'll tell us about, where he empowered 750 journalists to tell stories with their phones in 2010. He has covered many events since 2010, including the Syrian civil war with just his phone. In 2018, he co-founded, as I mentioned, Hashtag Our Stories, turning communities into in over 40 countries to tell their stories on social media. Yusuf, welcome to the show.
Good to be here. Thank you so much for having me. It's always great to be in Dubai, and I've always wanted to meet the team here at Lovin. And yeah, I'm so impressed by everything you guys do, really.
And I've also heard you speak many times and seen your stuff on social media. You're an innovator. You're a storyteller. How did you get into it?
Thank you so much. You know, I had a middle-class lack of direction, had a marketing degree, and then actually rocked up in Times Square, New York City, looking up at these big billboards. And I saw like a billboard of a guy in like tighty-whitey underwear. And in that moment, I flicked. I was like, I don't want to be a marketer anymore. I don't really want to sell people things that they don't need, but I'm still a storyteller. I ended up getting a scholarship to do journalism in South Africa, and I fell in love with it. It was like a, you know, a hand in a glove. I was like, what? You actually get paid to travel around the world and talk to people. That's a job. And then I get it's a job.
Oh, that's so cool.
I wanted to be a foreign correspondent, though. I wanted to tell stories of wars and natural disasters. And when I asked all the various news organizations, they weren't as cool as you, right? They were these like old lame bosses. And they were like, no, you're too young. You don't have enough experience. So I basically gave the industry a middle finger. And in 2010, I started hitchhiking, catching rides from South Africa all the way to Syria, traveled 12,000 kilometers. And that was the beginning of a journalism adventure. I ended up in Congo in 2012 when an ammunition depot exploded. I ended up in Syria in 2014. I was in Egypt during the first Arab Spring. Went through many different jobs in newspapers and radio and television, but eventually ended up at CNN International in London.
That's a pretty impressive journey. You know, speaking about you being a foreign correspondent, I want to know about your journey from being a foreign correspondent with just your phone to co-founding Hashtag Our Stories.
Yeah, really exciting. That. Well, we rebranded. We're now called Scene TV because we're all about making communities feel seen. Basically, during my time at traditional media, I realized that they were so out of touch. When you look at the 2016 elections, most traditional media did not anticipate that Donald Trump was going to win that election. Why? Because they're speaking to pundits and experts and commentators. They were often more left-leaning than the average American. They were often more educated. They were totally out of touch with the biggest story. Same thing in the UK. Brexit happened, and all the traditional media organizations missed it. They didn't think Brexit was going to happen, and then it happened. And it was like, actually, if you were speaking to communities outside of this bubble of London, if you're speaking to real people on the ground, you would have realized that there was a lot of resentment around migrant communities. There was a lot of racism. There was a lot of reasons why Brexit would happen. So I realized media were out of touch. And the only way to change that was to create a more diverse media landscape. I looked out when I came into the room just now. I saw pictures of your whole team on the wall. That's what a newsroom should look like. It should look diverse and representative of a global interconnected world. But that's not what newsrooms look like. In fact, when I was working at CNN International, there were 200 of us in London. Guess how many of us identified as Muslim? I was the only one I knew of, which is crazy.
Wow. But an international department.
In London. London's almost a Muslim country.
Yeah.
So they would be coming to me and asking me, hey, what's your opinion on this story in the Middle East? What's your opinion on this story in the Muslim world? Don't ask me, go and find an expert. So basically my wife and I quit our jobs. She was a banker, I was a journalist, and we traveled all over the world. We traveled to, you name a country, we went there. We trained up thousands and thousands of people how to tell stories with mobile phones. We trained 20,000 people. We created this army of like mobile journalists, mojos. And what that meant is we could then start curating and collecting voices from all over the place. This is not random user-generated content. This is people we'd worked with. But of course, that model wasn't very scalable, right? Me having to fly around and train people. So then we started developing tools. And now we've developed a series of tools where people can open their camera, they can tell stories, and they reach our audience. We've now got 8 million subscribers at CNTV.
You said that CNTV, CNTV,
yeah.
It's about making people feel seen.
Yeah.
How do you guys do that? How do you make people feel seen?
So it starts with understanding the power of storytelling. And I think you guys know it full well, right? You're in the media business. But storytelling at its worst is like fluff and PR. At its best, it's what brings people together. Storytelling is what convinces us to get behind a religion. Storytelling is what convinces us to do something about climate change. And for us, storytelling can help you realize that you have more in common with somebody than you have apart. So for example, we've done over 500 videos from Gaza post October 7th. And we did many videos before October 7th as well. Those videos hopefully create a connection with individuals on the ground. You can meet a young man and say, oh wow, he's just like me. He used to watch Netflix and have a PlayStation. And through no fault of this person's life, their circumstances have led them to the position that they're in, that they're a refugee today. So that's where I believe storytelling can bring people together and create a more empathetic and understanding world.
Mm. See, Yusuf, you seem very well-spoken. So I really have to ask, you know, how did the CNN and the Hindu Times shape your journey? How did it empower you to become a journalist, a better journalist than you ever thought you'd be?
Oh, in so many different ways. You know, at different points in your career, and sometimes when you're young, you don't really realize what you're learning until afterwards. But in retrospect, you've learned a lot. Working in television for 5 years and in newspapers taught me to write and to be a storyteller. Working at the Hindustan Times, and that was in South Africa, by the way. Working at the Hindustan Times in India taught me scale. It taught me the idea that, like, for example, my job there was to train 750 journalists in one newsroom. Imagine one newsroom had 750 journalists. Well, the brand, how to tell stories with phones and scale. And I also learned a lot about fragmentation of devices. If I have to ask us what phones we have, we have one of two or three types of phones. We had 70 different types of phones in the newsroom, ranging from like $5 phones to like $1,000 phones. So India taught me scale. CNN taught me monetization. They are a digital media brand that one of the few that have successfully monetized. And I was specifically working on Snapchat there. I was publishing on Snapchat. So I was starting to get a sense, okay, there's money here. We can monetize. And that's, I suppose, like a follow-up question is, well, how the hell do we monetize? How do we make money? And one of the great ways we do that is programmatic advertising. So we will create content, we'll publish it on Facebook and Snapchat, and we'll earn revenue from that. And it's incredibly lucrative. We've done $9 million on revenue just on Snapchat alone with these kinds of selfie videos from around the world.
Incredible. Interesting about journalism, because you studied journalism, you worked in legacy media brands,
yeah.
And then you've trained lots of journalists. You know, and one of the views that we have here as a media company is, even though media is changing and you know, the mediums are changing, you know, the print, the TV, the radio is evolving, and digital obviously is on its own world, and you have lots of gadgets there. But what's your view on the traditional ethos of ethics of a journalist and the original journalism degree? Do you think that still holds, or do you think the sort of 20,000 people that you've trained or more, can they do the same job now as a trained journalist?
You know, sometimes people think when we get into the space of user-generated content that it is a threat to, you know, democratic values around the world, and it propagates false information and fake news. And it can certainly do that. But at the same time, I think user-generated content is one of the greatest sources of news that we have today. Without it, how would we know what's happening both on the front lines of the Ukraine war and in Gaza? So it has immense value. What is happening is, as billions of people come online and are able to publish content, journalists are required more than ever before. And especially with this floodgate opening of generative AI, which makes it even more confusing. We need brilliant journalists who can separate fact from fiction, who can identify powerful voices from the noise. And I think people often think, oh, well, if you're publishing on TikTok or Snapchat, then Are the standards different? No. Whether you are publishing on Snapchat, you should be willing to put that on the front page of any newspaper around the world. You should be willing to put it on any billboard around the world. And to be honest, you're just as liable, right? If you defame somebody or do something that's factually accurate, you're just as likely to be sued. So the ethics of journalism remain the same. Do I think you need a journalism degree to be a journalist? No. Actually, some of the best journalists I know, including my co-founder and wife, Sameha Omar, she never went to journalism school. She was a banker. She's a much better journalist than I am. Being a good journalist is about being determined to be diligent and factually accurate. Being the one person in the room that can slow down the process. Say, hey guys, sorry, I know we're about to publish, but I've got an issue with this. Being brave. Not being first, but being getting it right.
Do you think journalism should hold people to account, or is that the job of the law?
Oh, I think journalism should absolutely hold people to account. I think it is the watchdog on society. There's a direct correlation between countries that have a lack of corruption and have a free press.
You know, you covered the Syrian civil war. A question that we have for you is, do you have any memorable moments from that?
The Syrian civil war was the singular worst thing that I've ever seen. I was very young. I was smuggled into the country. I was literally put in, I was traveling with a group called the Gift of the Givers. It was an NGO, and we were put in these like metal drums, which were used for fuel, and pulled across a river. And we spent about 2 weeks building a hospital in a place called Darkush in Idlib. And it was supposed to be safe, but from the first day that we got there, a rocket came and smashed the top of a mountain that was supposed to be protecting us. And the things I saw there, one can't unsee. I think when you're young, your risk part of your brain is potentially not as developed as when you get older. Would I go again? Never, ever, ever, ever. I wouldn't even go 1 centimeter into that kind of area. I have a child now, and I'm at a very different stage in my life. I also think there are better, and I think it's one of the reasons we launched Scene TV. It's like Yusuf can go out and tell stories as an individual. And as an individual, I can go out and shoot maybe 1 story a day or 2 stories a day, and I could potentially lose my life doing that as a foreign correspondent. But if I can empower communities to tell their stories, it's a much more scalable thing, and that skill set lives on a lot longer than I do.
You know, I'm curious about something, you know, covering a war, did it make you want to be a journalist more?
Yeah, at the time. I think you'll be surprised. Like, we'd go to bed at night and you'd hear like artillery and mortar landing sometimes just a few hundred meters away from us. And it got really serious. The guy whose house I was staying at in Syria died. And I remember like frequently calling my wife and saying, you know, I just got married. I was like, I this could be the night. I have no idea. I'm a terrible husband. A good husband should just be like, everything's fine. Don't worry. But she could see it because I was doing these live broadcasts on television. At the time, the adrenaline gets you. You're in the spirit of things are moving in action, and it almost doesn't feel real. When you see incredibly traumatic things, at least for me in my brain, it didn't feel real. Going home is when you start to process it. Going home is when I used to get severe nightmares. I used to, you know, wake up and think my legs had been amputated. And I think now, in 2024, there's much more of an appreciation for mental health and therapy and trauma counseling. But back then, if you wanted to maintain that role in a newsroom, if you wanted to be that foreign correspondent, you almost didn't feel comfortable to show that vulnerability or weakness. So you just kind of got on with it. You just got home and moved on to the next one.
You just had to say yes.
Yeah, you just didn't even take the time to process it.
Other than sort of, this is kind of a long-winded question, but other than the macro themes of proximity, racism, personal interests or agendas or geopolitics, why do you think there's a disparity in why some events get covered over others? You know, I was in the region then, and the Western world did talk about the Arab Spring on Twitter, and there was an Syrian crisis. There were things, there wasn't enough, right? I've read some books on serious sins.
Drives me insane.
And I'm shocked what happened then. And I'm told that we're told that it was covered on social media. It wasn't, to the degree of what went on. And now with the genocide taking place in Gaza, we're seeing more, but more to a degree that's shocking for some people. And some of it is shadow banned, but there's definitely more. That's, we have two journalists in Gaza since last summer, and we've covered a lot more, and we launched Love in Khartoum a year and a half ago than we've covered there. And I'm just wondering, why do you, apart from the obvious reasons, are there any other reasons why one situation is covered more than others?
It makes me sick, to be honest. And the idea that not all lives are equal. And you see it very clearly when you work in traditional media organizations. There'll be a landslide that kills 200 people in Ethiopia, but we'll be covering a listeriosis outbreak in the US. I think part of it comes, at least in this part of the world, from the demonization that the Arab world has experienced over the last 50 years.
Yeah.
They have primarily framed, I say this, Western media primarily framed Arabs through the prism of security and counterterrorism. So you lose empathy. We have dehumanized people of color and the loss of their lives. People were in Europe devastated by Ukraine. They had the most fundraising, they had world record fundraisings take place over 24-hour and 48-hour periods. We saw people book empty Airbnbs just so they could support people in Ukraine. Why? You even heard it, that the journalists were vocally racist in their coverage. They said, these are not some people in Afghanistan. These are blonde-haired, blue-eyed. They look like me or you. It's almost like they're not expected to be at war, and people that look like us are expected to be at war. And it's this framing that's being built.
So that's more from the media choices.
Yeah, but over a long period of time that has dehumanized the Arab part of the world. So their casualties are insignificant. And also positioning us as, and the Middle East is like always having been refugees. There is no backstory. You know, they're just this mass of people.
You know, one of the original missions of Facebook was to make the world more open and connected.
Yes.
In the timeline along with your career and what you've done as well. And social media, has pros and cons necessarily. But, we would say, hey, the headline that the media chooses are the algorithms now that pushes videos higher. But there's a third player here, and the third player is the person receiving. And sometimes some stories catch imagination more than others, even if the algorithm is shoving something, even if sometimes, like you're saying about Brexit, sometimes people decide what's important. And I do think some of the what's happening now, and we've seen that in campuses, we've seen it in the UK. Mm. I do think that the world is being more empathetic too. Mm. You know, I don't think we really talk about Islamophobia enough, but I do think the world is waking up to the fact that, because 10, 15 years ago, I don't think they cared as much. And I think maybe they care a little bit more now as well.
There's a seismic shift taking place, and it's incredibly exciting. And over the long run, the world is getting better, right? All indices move in the right direction. There's little blips in the system, but we're moving the right way. And specifically around like perception, if you look at the recent Pew study that was down, they found that Gen Zs and millennials are actually sympathetic to the Palestinian cause. It really is our parents' generation and those that are older that are still maintaining very Zionist ideologies. So yeah, there's 1,000,000% of change taking place. With regard to content, I actually switched the word algorithm with audience, because often we often as media companies we're like, the algorithm's doing this, the algorithm's doing that. What is algorithms doing other than serving audiences to try and get them to watch for as long as possible? What do we have to do? We have to pivot as quickly as possible. And we just have to work harder too. I think if we approach these heavy subjects like Sudan, like Palestine, from a position of like purely, oh, this is so sad, this is so bad, people are going to stop watching. There's almost like a sense of rubble fatigue at this stage, right? There's only so much trauma that you can watch. But if you can go into Rafah and find the story of the Isaac Newton of Rafah, it's a story we did about this kid that was, you know, creating these little wind turbines so he could create electricity. That then flips the narrative. It comes from a position of like awe and inspiration. And I think there's a moment right now where a lot of the world is celebrating Arab culture. right? The flags are all over the world. The kefir is all over the world. Like, Arab culture and Palestinian culture is becoming like this cultural global icon. I just came from London. I saw more Palestinian flags than I saw British flags. So I think that there's this really exciting storytelling opportunity as well to celebrate this part of the world. And I think if we do celebrate this part of the world and we do say, yo, our languages are cool, our food is cool, our fashion is cool, that's another way to create empathy and understanding. That's another way to bring people together.
Mm, absolutely. Well said. Words.
And I just have another question for you. You mentioned Gen Z. You know, if you know our generation, we question everything and we're very opinionated and we're not afraid to actually show that. Has this affected journalism and the storytelling that you guys do?
In the most positive way. In the most positive way. I think both Gen Zs that are in our newsroom and Gen Zs in our audience are incredibly critical. They're incredibly socially, environmentally aware, and they're not afraid to speak truth to power. They all hold us to a higher standard. So absolutely, I think it has a net positive.
And you know, for a young aspiring journalist like me, do you have any advice to give? Do you have any advice to give the audience?
Two things. One, what are you waiting for? Sometimes I meet young people that are like, oh my God, I would love to have a travel show. Oh, I'd love to have a cooking show. Oh, I'd love to be a journalist. I'm like, what are you waiting for? You have a 4K camera in your pocket. You have a mobile phone with a 4K camera. That's like a Ferrari, and most of us are driving in first gear. If you want to be a travel journalist, save up some money, book a flight, or even just go to Sharjah and start telling stories. You know what I mean? You don't have to wait for this somebody to give you something on a silver platter. You can do it right now. The barrier of entry has never been lower. Get stuff out into the world. Don't be precious. Watch the analytics and focus on it. So that's my first piece of advice. My second piece of advice is build a skill set for how people will consume content tomorrow. It's like a train track. If Dubai are building a train, they don't want to build a train to where people live today or even where they used to live yesterday. You want to build trains to where people are living tomorrow. And it's the same. I meet too many young people who are like training to become purely a TV anchor. That's their worldly objective. And it's like, really? You think that's going to be the skill set that's going to be around in when you graduate in 5 years or 10 years time? Like, think digital, think immersive, think wearable. The future is moving very, very quickly. And your ability to, your greatest skill is your ability to learn more skills.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. But, you know, just to come to the defense of my generation, I think they're a bit afraid because, you know, now you can get canceled easily. You know, obviously, you know, we have a lot of internet now. You know, people can just say whatever they want. But, you know, yes, it's easy to enter, but you can easily be kicked out.
You are right. But I think if you are electing to be in this industry, media, to be honest, if you can't take the heat, you got to get out of the kitchen. Like, this is an industry where you will be held accountable, where you are going to put things out into the world that have huge consequence, where we have a massive responsibility to educate populations around the world. So I agree with you. I think I understand where that comes from, this position of like being cautious of not wanting to expose themselves. Unfortunately, this is a high stakes industry and you've got to be ready for it.
Yeah, and I definitely agree with you. You know, being held accountable, it's not a bad thing. I don't think it destroys your entire timeline of everything that you've done. It just makes you better.
For sure.
Yeah. You should talk to us about the gadgets, the toys that you have in front of us.
Yeah.
Are you there? What are they?
I am obsessed with the idea that by 2030, in 5 years' time, all of us on this meeting, everyone watching, their primary computer is not going to be their phone anymore. They're going to be wearing glasses on their face, smart glasses, and they're going to be overlaying the internet onto the world. I believe this more than anything. That's why I've spent the last 10 years basically wearing, every day of my life, I wear some form of smart glasses, trying to understand this space.
What have you learned?
Oh, I've learned that it is going to liberate us. I think sometimes people think when we are wearing in this virtual reality, metaverse world, that we're not going to be present. I think that our mobile phones have made us less present. I think we're all walking around like this all the time. And you know, I see my son through this. I don't see him with my own eyes. So I actually think when done right, it's not going to be a casino in your face. It's going to be really liberating. I'll give you an example. I mean, and all the companies from Microsoft to Google, they're all making massive investments in this space. So it's definitely worth watching, anticipating, and starting to build media companies. To be honest, Every single part of our lives is going to change. If you are in healthcare, you should be thinking about this. If you are in fitness, you should be thinking about this. If you're in retail, you should definitely be thinking about this. It's a horizontal technology that kind of changes our interface with the internet. Almost like AI changes the back end of the internet, but the front end of the internet is this.
This stuff.
Yeah.
So, so you're putting on now, this is the Meta Ray-Ban.
These are Meta's Ray-Ban glasses. I don't actually know if camera glasses are allowed in Dubai, but let's go with it. These ones are really interesting. They don't have a screen. They do have a camera, but they have AI integrated, which means I can go to a store, I can pick up a product and say, hey, is this good for my diet if I'm a diabetic? It'll look at it, it'll understand what it is, it'll give me information.
Where do you receive that information?
You hear it.
You hear it.
You hear it. I could pick up jeans and say, hey, can I get this cheaper on Noon? It'll search, it'll give me that information. Oh, wow. So the camera is becoming the primary input to technology.
Where's it getting the information from?
It's using the camera to scan the object.
Googling it or
yeah, Microsoft? It's cross-referencing that image across the internet and trying to understand what's in it.
But does it tell you that there's a partnership with Bing or Google, or we don't really know?
Meta say they're building their own AI model.
Yeah, okay.
I think it's called Llama.
Yeah, this one.
Welcome to try it on. And if you say, hey, Meta, what's the weather today in Dubai? It should tell you.
Oh, it made a noise. Yeah, okay. Hey, Meta, what's the weather today in Dubai like?
I hope it can process that beautiful accent.
Okay, let's wait to hear it come back.
So that's really interesting because it's a camera-based input technology. What I learned from that device is that a lot of my interactions with the internet don't actually require a screen. When I'm like, hey, what time does my local coffee shop close? I don't need a screen. I just need to hear it. Mm. It's kind of like Siri, right? Mm. When I say, hey, call my wife, again, I don't need a screen for that. The other thing I really like about those ones, and I'm not sponsored for this, by the way, it's just my opinion. I'll tell you the things I don't like too. The thing I really like about that is when I'm on a WhatsApp call, I can switch the camera to the glasses. So I'm carrying my kid. My parents can watch me carrying my kid live. It live streams my perspective on a WhatsApp call. And that integration into WhatsApp, Instagram, Messenger is super valuable.
Wow.
Also, I'm a mad AirPods wearer. Like I wear AirPods all the time. Because it has speakers, I don't have to worry about earphones anymore. Mm. So I think that also helps with utility. So that's kind of like level one. And I think you're going to start to see over the next 2 to 3 years, more companies playing in the space and more people starting to rock smart glasses. Obviously, sometimes people are nervous. There's a camera around. Are you filming me? Are you not filming me? I think it's really important to have, you guys can see like a little flashing light over there. It's really important for that to exist, for people to know when they're being captured or filmed. The next level up from that is like this. This is the Snapchat Spectacles. And believe it or not, this is not for sale. It's just a developer device.
They've changed a lot. Yeah, they're different to the original Spectacles.
Yeah, there's only a handful of these in the world. I don't know of any in Dubai at the moment. This is a computer on your face. I am looking at you, but I have information overlaid onto my world. And we've done some...
What information?
Oh, so for example, I'm Muslim, okay? I was born and raised Muslim. I don't speak any Arabic, which means every time I pray Salah, I don't actually know what I'm saying. I know, it's terrible.
But it's amazing. I'm guessing that this helps you with it.
I'll show you. Yes, exactly. So try these on and I will, you're welcome to rock those. So the first product I created in here was actually so I could see the Quran in English because it would improve my life. So I'm going to play that for you now. So now I see the Quran in English while I'm praying. And maybe there's going to be some ustad that's going to tell me, hey, I don't know if that's okay.
Yeah, it's okay. I'm a Muslim
cool,
too.
Cool, right?
Thank you.
Wow.
I'll give you another experience. I made this for the city of Dubai. So I wanted to recreate the experience of what the growth of Dubai looks like. And I'll just play that for you now.
You're controlling it with which device? The Snap?
Yeah, I mean, you can control it yourself too, yeah. With voice, with touch.
Oh, I see an image of the desert in Dubai.
Okay, so he's seeing an image of the desert in Dubai.
And Burj Khalifa going off.
But yet, he's still present. He's with us in the room. It's not like he's in this like this metaverse. He's still very present.
I can see you as well, yeah.
It's so crazy how like they're loud.
Sick, right?
Yeah, yeah, it's very cool.
And like, imagine this is going to get smaller and smaller and smaller.
Yeah.
So we've done some amazing stuff. We've done an experience in the city of Boston where you can walk around and see history overlaid onto the city. Or for example, in South Africa, they have all these colonial statues and a lot of people find it very controversial because they often celebrate people who did some pretty nasty stuff. I just thought they needed more context. So you can look at the statue, it comes to life, and then the general's like, I was a fantastic man. And the horse is like, no, you weren't, you're a racist. And they debate his legacy. When my wife was pregnant, we were able to overlay the baby's development onto her body so we could see it week by week. This is what we're talking about. We're talking about the idea of the internet overlaid onto our physical world. And that's exciting. That's the ability to see directions to the local masjid. That's the ability to like go to a wedding and know the person's name before they come up to you.
Yeah.
People think about a dystopian future. I think it's an amazing one. And then, of course, this is the Vision Pro by Apple, right? And I think when Apple are making investments in the space, people start to pay attention. And I am now, even though it looked like I'm in a different world, I'm looking at you right now. I'm very, very present. And it's basically my entire iPhone. I can see my photos, I can see my keynotes, my emails, I can see my laptop screen when I want to. I can really function productively in this environment. Mm. This is an incredible television. I've got like a big cinema screen whenever I want it. This is not perfect. It's still a little bit heavy. The ecosystem hasn't been fully developed, but it's only going to get better from here. Apple are very bullish about spatial computing. They are very bullish that the future iPhone is on the face, and they are really, really investing a lot of money to try and win in that arena. And I think a lot of us should already be thinking about what kind of content are we making in these environments? How are we bringing the city of Dubai to life through these kinds of glasses? Imagine the ability for real estate people, right? They're constantly saying, hey, I'm building this hotel. Now I can see what the hotel's like. I can visualize it. I can walk inside. I can design things together. It really is an incredible future that we're heading into. I think our kids will look back and they won't understand a world where we didn't have information in front of our eyes, just 2 centimeters away from our optical nerve.
Wow.
I will quote you on that in a decade. Thanks for the demo.
It's been inspiring. It's been amazing.
Thank you.
Trying out these things that haven't been here. It's good inspiration, isn't it?
Yeah. How do you feel, Ward?
But you guys are already ahead of your time. I mean, you have a VR room right here in the building. So as you were constructing this building and as you were thinking about the future of media, you were front and center of this revolution.
Yeah, we're watching to see how it goes, and it is, I think it's inspiring to hear you talk about it, because you're one person who's obviously does believe that this will be mass consumer items and in different ways. And
it has to happen, because the mobile phone sucks.
True, yeah. It's been great for so long, but things move so fast.
I just feel like it owns too much of our lives.
Yeah.
We have to stop looking down and start looking out again.
Yeah.
But when you're looking out, people can't see your eyes, though.
But when it gets to this, contact lenses.
I agree with you.
Bring me back in 10 years. Let's see if I was right.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming today.
Thanks, Yusuf.
It was really lovely hearing your story.
Thanks for having you on.
It's good to be here.
Yeah. All right, guys.
Thank you so much for watching Smashy Business Show. Don't forget to check our Smashy Business channel on Instagram.
And we'll be releasing a special interview episode with Mohammed Nagati, who's a very successful regional businessman. He was in the studio last night, and that will be going out in their special Sunday interview special this week.